Thank you very much. Well, it is a great place. Okay, Mark. Here. Are you happy now?
Yeah.
Well, it is a great pleasure to be in Canada once again. I thank the organizers for inviting me, and I'm delighted to participate in this meeting on non-commutative geometry. So, it seems to me quite clear that in non-commutative geometry, as in any subject in mathematics, we want to develop the subject in and of itself. But, of course, we also want to try to apply the ideas that we have and the methods we have to problems that are external to the subject. And I think representation theory is ready for this, or maybe we are ready to do it through representation theory. I think Nigel Hickson spoke here. And what Nigel was telling you about Lie groups is very much the same sort of thing that I'll be trying to telling you about today, what I've been doing with Anne-Marie Aubert and Roger Plyman. So one of the things that we have learned from Alain, in fact, you can see that this is happening, that we are applying what we are doing to problems external to the subject. So it's like, Inspector Maigret. You know, with Inspector Maigret, it was always chercher la femme, right? But now for us, I think it's chercher le problème externe. So... So one of the great things we learned from Alain is that if you have a C-star algebra, there are interesting and worthwhile subalgebras. I mean, if you take the point of view, I am only interested in C-star algebras, and I will never think about the interesting and worthwhile subalgebras of the C-star algebra, that's not the way to go. So this is one of the things we have learned from Alain, I think, over the years. So. A very simple, a very elementary C-star algebra is just the continuous functions on S1. And of course, within there, we have the rapid decay functions, and that's the S1 functions. And then within that, we have the Laurent polynomials in one variable. And then, of course, you can go bigger. You can go to the von Neumann algebra. And actually, I learned recently, some of the young mathematicians, Andreas Thomason, and some of the others, Thomas Schickenthal, they even have a larger von Neumann algebra of unbounded operators which are affiliated in the sense of Voronovich to the operators in here. So we have all these different algebras, and all of this is part of the picture. And having said all that, today's talk will be here. So today's talk will be on these very, very sort of algebraic algebras, and what you can do with that. And the basic topological invariant, when you're working with an algebra in this spirit, the basic topological invariant is the periodic cyclic homology done purely algebraically. There's no completing of the tensor products. It's done purely algebraically. And in the examples that we will be looking at today, one of the interesting features of these examples is that as far as periodic cyclic homology goes, you could take Alain Kahn's approach and use this rapid decay algebra, the approach that Alain has used so successfully, where, of course, there is a completion of the tensor products, but you will get the same answer. That is, working purely algebraically here and working as Alain does here, you will get exactly the same answer. And that answer, up to torsion, modulo torsion, that answer is the K-theory of the C-star algebra. And this will be happening throughout the algebras that will be dealt with today. So the moral of the story is, perhaps, that you might say, if you, maybe you are a much more reasonable person, but if you are not a reasonable person, you might say, well, I'm not interested in algebras like this. I mean, that would be a highly... No, no, no. The algebras dealt with today will not be commutative. The algebras, the particular example I have in mind today is that we have a reductive p-adic group. Well, I'll... Oh, I'm not saying that something like this will always be true. Oh, absolutely not. Oh, no. Yeah. Actually, that's an interesting point, because the algebras that will be dealt with today are all sort of algebraic geometry type algebras. What we'll have is what's called a reductive algebraic group. So I'll take a moment to give some explanation of that. For the reductive algebraic group, you have, so to speak, this picture. That is, you have the Hecke algebra of the group, which I'll explain in a moment what this is. The Hecke algebra of the group. That's in this spirit. Then there is the Harish-Chandra-Schwarz algebra, invented by Harish-Chandra. Those are rapid decay functions. That is in this spirit here. Then finally, you have the algebra that was used by Alami in our conjecture, the reducing star algebra. And then, of course, you can go on to von Neumann algebra. In this picture, for a reductive p-adic group, it is a beautiful result of a young Dutch mathematician. What is his name? Solow. Who said that? Yeah, I'm just curious who's saying it. You are saying it. Yeah. It is a beautiful result of Martin Solow that if you take, that it works this way for any reductive p-adic group. That is, if you take the periodic cycle homology in the sense of Alain Kahn here as a Frechet algebra, that is exactly the same as the purely algebraic periodic cyclic homology that you have here, and that both of them are the same as, up to torsion, are the same. When you tensor with the complex numbers, you get the same thing as the K-theory of the reducing star algebra. And you can take this result of Martin Solow as one version. It's perhaps not 100% exactly the same as Vincent Lefort's result, that the conjecture of Alain Kahnemi is true for reductive p-adic groups, but it's very, very close. You can take it as one version of the conjecture of Alain Kahnemi, that conjecture is true for reductive p-adic groups. So, having that the conjecture is true, the question is now to continue to go on and to do something. I mean, roughly speaking, the fact that the conjecture is true means that at some topological level, you have solved the representation theory of this group. Now, let's try to get to honest representation theory, to actual representation theory, and see what we can do, guided by the fact that the conjecture of Alain Kahnemi, due to the work of Vincent Lefort, beautiful work of Vincent Lefort, and also this I think also very beautiful work of Martin Solow, is true for these groups. Okay, so I said we have all learned a lot from Alain, and here's a picture of a mathematician learning from Alain. I'm learning from Alain. This was at Oberwolfach just a few months ago. All right, so suppose we have reductive p-adic group. So, I won't go into exactly what that means, except to say that these are the classical groups, these are the usual classical groups, except done over the p-adic field, or perhaps over a finite extension of the p-adic numbers. So it can be, example would be GLNF, SLNF, or F is any finite extension. Well, when we talk about a representation of such a group, what do we mean? Well, it just means we have a vector space over the complex numbers, and we have a map of groups to the automorphisms of that vector space. Now, I will explain in a moment what is a smooth representation, because these are the representations that are... When Harris Chandra studied these groups, he first began by studying them exactly as he had studied Lie groups. That is, he studied the unitary representations. These are locally compact groups. It makes perfectly good sense to talk about unitary representations. And the support of the Plancherel measure and the whole picture that he had developed for Lie groups. But he realized after a while that it was better to study the smooth representations. The reduced unitary dual that we are used to from C-star algebras will be included in a canonical way into the new dual, which is called the smooth dual. And it's this smooth dual that is relevant for number theory, for local Langlands conjecture, and so on, and so on. Okay, now, two representations are equivalent. Well, that's the usual. Now for a smooth representation, typically, this will not be a Hilbert space. Typically, this will be a vector space with a countable dimension. And so two are equivalent. It's the usual definition. You have an intertwining operator, which is an isomorphism of vector spaces. So standard definition of equivalent representations. And we say a representation is irreducible. That's a completely standard definition. Representation is irreducible means that there's no subspace that is preserved except the whole space and zero. Okay, so the p-adic numbers in this natural topology is locally compact. It happens also to be totally disconnected. So G is a locally compact, totally disconnected topological group. So it can be studied just as Lie groups are studied. However, we say, so then we make this basic definition. So this is a very basic definition, but it's also extremely simple definition. We say that a representation is smooth if for every vector in the vector space, you look at the subgroup which fixes that vector, and we require that to be open. We require that to be an open subgroup. Now, an open subgroup is also closed because all the cosets will be open. So you take all the union of all the non-identity cosets, that's open. So it's clopen. It's a clopen subgroup. All right, so this is the basic definition of smooth representation. This means that we are, typically this vector space will have a countable basis. And this means that we are, basically this means we are looking at the vector space as being topologized by the discrete topology. This condition means that the map, see, G has a natural locally compact topology. The map from G cross V to V is continuous, where V is given the discrete topology. So these are the smooth representations. And then the smooth or admissible dual of the group, sometimes it's called smooth, and sometimes it's called admissible. The reason that they have these two terminologies, as far as I can make out, is so that it shouldn't be too easy for outsiders to get into the subject. Because they are exactly the same thing. So the smooth or admissible dual of G, denoted G with a hat, there's a little hat on there, is the set of equivalence classes of smooth irreducible representation. So this is one of the basic problems in this whole area, is to describe this in some meaningful way, to describe this smooth dual. Well, G is locally compact, so we can do what we usually do in representation theory. We fix a Haar measure, let's say left invariant, and now the Hecke algebra is by definition. So the Hecke algebra HG, it's the convolution algebra of all locally constant, compactly supported, complex value functions from the group to the complex numbers. So the addition in the group is just, in the algebra, the addition in the Hecke algebra is just naive pointwise addition. The interesting thing is the multiplication, which is convolution. That's the multiplication. Now, this is a dense but not holomorphically closed subalgebra of the reduced C-star algebra. So you have this diagram like this, these inclusions, the Hecke algebra included in the Harris-Chandra-Schwarz algebra included in the reduced C-star algebra. And like I say, it's a remarkable, I think very interesting result of Martin Solovelt that the periodic cyclic homology and the K-theory work out just as in this very easy example. So these algebras, of course, are not commutative. Well, that's a very interesting point. The locally constant ones are continuous, but the continuous ones is a little bit more than just locally constant. Yeah, yeah. That's a well taken point. Yeah. Think a little bit about the example of the Cantor set, something like that. It's an interesting point. It's a point that has to be settled. Yeah. The important thing about the Hecke algebra is that it's very, very algebraic in nature. It should be thought of as a non-commutative affine variety. That's the way it should be viewed. Now, when we talk about a representation of this Hecke algebra, that has the standard algebraic definition. It's just a homomorphism of algebras over the complex numbers from the Hecke algebra to the endomorphisms of some complex vector space. Now, the Hecke algebra does not have a unit. It won't have a unit because the unit would be the Dirac function at the identity element of the group, because the multiplication is convolution, but that's not there. That's not in the algebra. So it does not have a unit.
Well, maybe that's the question.
Sure.
How important is it that the values can be arbitrary complex numbers and not just those with rational or real imaginary parts?
That's actually fairly important, because if we want to think of this as a non-commutative affine variety, when you take an affine variety and you take the algebra of you take what's called its coordinate algebra, or its coordinate ring, the algebraic functions on it, they take on arbitrary complex numbers as well. Well, you could do something like that. That is, these algebras in a certain sense, there is a sense in which these algebras can be reduced to algebras over the rational numbers. That's true. But to what? That's fairly likely to be true. These things are actually the basic building blocks that occur here are called Iwahori-Hecke algebras. Those are certain deformations of algebras of that you get by considering the group algebra of Coxeter groups, and all these things that we are saying just now are true for those algebras, and those algebras are the basic building blocks for these. So there is some truth in what you are saying, George. Okay. Now, the Hecke algebra does not have a unit. A representation of the Hecke algebra, since it doesn't have a unit, we cannot talk about unital representation. So instead, we talk about non-degenerate representation. So a representation of the Hecke algebra is non-degenerate if it satisfies this standard. Of course, this is just algebra now. So what does that mean, that non-degeneracy condition? That means that given any vector in the vector space, given any vector V in the vector space, you can find other vectors, V1 up to VR, and then elements in the Hecke algebra, A1 up to AR, such that V is equal to A1 V1 plus AR VR. So that's the non-degeneracy condition on a representation. Now, if you have a smooth representation of the pianic group, then it integrates just by familiar construction from C star algebras. It integrates to give a representation of the Hecke algebra. It integrates in this way to give a representation of the Hecke algebra, because the multiplication in the Hecke algebra is convolution. And this operation of integration, this gives an equivalence of categories between the category of smooth representations of the original group, the original pianic group, and non-degenerate representations of the Hecke algebra. So, in other words, smooth representations of the group and non-degenerate representations of the Hecke algebra is the same thing. So, okay. In particular, this gives the bijection of sets from the smooth dual, the thing we are trying to describe, to the set of primitive ideals. So I'll define in a moment what is a primitive ideal. Alain has made a good point about this. In particular, is maybe not appropriate. The point is that we have a type 1 situation here. These are type 1 algebras. An irreducible representation is determined up to equivalence by its primitive ideal, by its ideal, by its null space. So let's see, a non-degenerate representation of the Hecke algebra, this is defining irreducibility. So we say this is standard definition of irreducible, standard usual definition of irreducible, and then a primitive ideal is exactly and precisely the null space of an irreducible representation of the Hecke algebra. So that's what we mean by a primitive ideal, and this is a type 1 situation. An irreducible representation is determined up to equivalence by its ideal, an irreducible representation of the Hecke algebra. Now so we get this bijection of sets from the primitive ideal, the set of primitive ideals, to the original smooth dual that we wish to describe. Well, what has been gained from this? Something has actually been gained. As in this morning's talk before me, there's this wonderful topology, right? There's the Zariski topology, here it's being called the Jacobson topology, right? And spec, spec and so on. And this is a fun sort of like spec, this somewhat spec-like creature. It is non-commutative. We are doing non-commutative geometry. This has a topology, the Jacobson topology. So what does that mean? Well, you take a subset S and the closure in the Jacobson topology. So these primitive ideals tend to be very big. In fact, generally speaking, they are maximal ideals. So you take a bunch of primitive ideals, you intersect them, you get some little ideal. Then you take all the primitive ideals that contain this little ideal. That's the closure operation. That's called the Jacobson topology. And so you give it this topology. So this is very much like what's called the Zariski topology. In fact, the Zariski topology is a special case of this. So if you have an affine variety over the complex numbers, you take its coordinate algebra, then the primitive ideals is just a set of C rational points of the variety. In other words, it's just a set of points of the variety. And the Jacobson topology is the Zariski topology. That is, it's the topology in which closed sets are the sub-varieties. And then, the original problem of describing the smooth dual is the same thing as describing the primitive ideal space of the Hecke algebra. Well, the primitive ideal space of the Heck algebra with its Jacobson topology is the disjoint union of its connected components. Why is that? That is because that is one of these utterly tautological things. Any topological space, no matter what sort of a topology you've put on there, is the union of its connected components. Two points are not in the same connected component if and only if you can find two open sets whose union is the whole space and whose intersection is empty, and one point is in one and the other point is in the other. And it follows from that definition immediately that any topological space is the disjoint union of its connected components. So pi naught, each connected component of the Cantor set consists of one point. No. Nobody said that a connected component has to be open. It's open if the space is locally connected. Yeah, it is. Of course, it's weird. I mean, point set topology. This is not a conference on point set topology, so I guess I can say that point set topology is weird. I mean, some people think. It is kind of weird. Okay. So, actually, in this particular case we are talking about, these actually turn out to be path connected. That is, in this particular case we are looking at here, the connected components of the primitive ideal space, they are actually the path connected components. That is, you can actually continuously deform from one. Yeah, they are open. They are open, yes. They are both open and closed. Yeah. They are both open and closed, and you can actually, given two irreducible representations or primitive ideals in the same component, you can actually make a continuous path from one to the other. In the example we are interested in. Okay, now so we take the set of connected components. Well, the Cantor set is totally disconnected. That's not true here. I mean, so that connected component is sort of meaningless in the Cantor set, whereas connected component here has some very interesting meaning. The pi naught, so we let pi naught of prim HG denote the set of connected components. Now, that's just a countable set, and it has no further structure. It's just a countable set. It is also known as the Bernstein spectrum of the group, that set, that countable set. And now, here is a little bit of notation. This is a little bit of notation. Each alpha contained in pi naught prim H of G, X sub alpha will denote the connected component. So for each alpha in this countable set, X sub alpha will denote that connected component. So the problem of describing the smooth dual has been reduced to the problem of describing each of these X alpha. What Alain is saying is right. The set of components, what's being denoted by pi naught, this is a countable set. The set of components. Yeah. And X alpha denotes the actual component. The component will have a cardinality equal, some of them can be finite. Sometimes you have what are called supercuspidal representations that stand alone. A component might be finite, just like you can have discrete series that stand alone for Lie groups. But generally speaking, the component will have the cardinality of the continuum. Well, that's usually what will happen is the component will have the cardinality of the real numbers. Okay. Any other questions on this? Okay, now, but the set of the connected components is countable. Now, the here's just a little bit of notation. C cross, I guess this is completely standard notation. It denotes the complex affine variety, C minus, you remove zero. The coordinate algebra of this is the Laurent polynomials in one variable. That's the coordinate algebra of this variety. Now, a complex torus is a complex affine variety such that there exists an, it's not, we don't require the isomorphism to be canonical. There's just some isomorphism of affine varieties from this affine variety T to a finite product of these C cross. We call that a complex torus. Now, Bernstein, Josef Bernstein, studied these issues, and he did some extremely interesting work on all this, but then he couldn't be bothered to write it up. So Deligne wrote it up for him. Pierre Deligne wrote it up. And Pierre Deligne's paper is called Le Centre de Bernstein. Okay, so Bernstein assigns to each alpha in the set of connected components a complex torus, T sub alpha, and a finite group, gamma sub alpha, acting on T sub alpha. Gamma sub alpha acts as automorphisms of that affine variety. In fact, it acts as automorphisms of that algebraic group. It's acting as automorphisms of this affine variety, and in fact, respects the group structure. Okay, Bernstein then forms the quotient, which is again an affine variety. It generally speaking, it will have singularities. It will be singular. And he proves that there's a surjective map, pi sub alpha, mapping the connected component, x sub alpha, onto this affine variety. So the connected component is already beginning to feel like it really wants to be an affine variety. I mean, the connected component is saying to Bernstein, I really am an affine variety and I wish you would make me into an affine variety. I went to what the Germans call a school in Münster a few years ago about p-adic groups, and Bernstein was one of the main speakers, and so I met him in the hallway in between talks, and I said, you know, Professor Bernstein, your theory is extraordinarily beautiful theory. And he just looked at me like I was a madman and turned around and walked away. And that was the end of that. The map pi alpha that Bernstein defined, see, the map pi alpha from the connected component to the quotient is referred to as the infinitesimal character or the central character. All right, there's a definite reason for this terminology, which I won't go into, but there's a very good reason for this terminology. Now, in Bernstein's work, throughout Bernstein's work, X sub alpha is a set. In other words, it's only a set. So you see, this is really inviting the point of view of non-commutative geometry. In his work, this is only a set. And since this thing is only a set, this map can only be a map of sets, even though this one is an affine variety. Bernstein proves that for each alpha, that if you fix an alpha, so you fix a connected component, his map is surjective, finite to one, and generically one to one. That is, you can remove a subvariety here. That subvariety is referred to as the subvariety of reducibility. You can remove a subvariety here and remove the preimage of that subvariety, and what's left, the map is one to one. That's what generically means in this context. Okay, now, What Anne-Marie Aubert and Roger Plyman and I are proposing, conjecturally, I mean, we are proposing a conjecture, is that this thing, in fact, is an affine variety, and this map, in fact, is a morphism of affine varieties, but what affine variety should this be? So in order to describe what affine variety it should be, we will use a construction that is familiar to anybody who has calculated, who has done cyclic homology calculations of cross-product algebras. I think the construction first appeared in the paper of Alain Canemie called Chern character for discrete groups, but it may have appeared elsewhere. Anyway, this is called the extended quotient. Let gamma be a finite group acting on an affine variety, let's say. The quotient variety, so like what Bernstein did, the quotient variety, you just collapse each orbit to a point. That gives you the quotient variety. Now, for each point in the variety, so given a point x in the variety, gamma sub x denotes the stabilizer group of x. So gamma subscript x is all group elements which fix that particular point in the variety. Then C of gamma sub x denotes the set of conjugacy classes of gamma sub x. Then the extended quotient, what we will define to be the extended quotient, is obtained by replacing the orbit of x by the set of conjugacy classes. Instead of just collapsing each orbit to a point, we shall replace each orbit by the set of conjugacy classes. And how do you do that? The way you do that, the explicit construction by which you do that is as follows. You take all pairs, gamma comma, so a group element and a point in the variety, such that the group element fixes the point. You call this, all these pairs, call that x tilde. So that, of course, is included within gamma cross x. This thing is an affine variety and is a subvariety of gamma cross x. But then the group, this finite group, gamma acts on x tilde, and it acts in this way. And like I say, this was in the paper of Alain and me from quite a while back, some years ago. So gamma cross x tilde. So you take a group element. Here we have one of these pairs, gamma, you let g act, you conjugate in the first variable, and then just apply your originally given action in the second variable. And then the extended quotient, denoted x slash slash gamma, is x tilde slash gamma. In other words, the extended quotient, x slash slash gamma, is the ordinary quotient for the action of gamma on x tilde. And the extended quotient is then an affine variety. So this is the extended quotient. Any question about what is the extended quotient? Now, we have the projection of the extended quotient on the ordinary quotient. If you take a pair, gamma comma x, such that gamma fixes x, you just map that to x. That then gives you a map from the extended quotient to the ordinary quotient. Okay, so the conjecture, and like I say, what happened was that Roger Plyman and I were calculating examples, trying to see how the conjecture of Alain and me actually works. What we wanted to do was see how the conjecture of Alain and me actually works. We calculated many examples over a period of many years, and we began to see a pattern in the examples. And then Anne-Marie Aubert joined in the effort. Well, you have to accept the principle that affine varieties is exactly, there's a sort of a Gelfand theorem. The commutative C-style algebra is the same thing as locally compact Hausdorff topological. Yeah, exactly, exactly right. The okay. Oh, you accept that? Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it can have singularities. It will have singularities. The In fact, in the example at hand, the example we shall be interested in, sitting within this quotient, there will be an orbifold. There will be, in a natural way, an orbifold. And that orbifold is what occurs in the unitary dual, in the reduced unitary dual. And this is a sort of an expansion of that. So we get this map from the extended quotient to the ordinary quotient. Okay, so Roger and I were calculating away, trying to see how the conjecture of Alain-Cahn actually works, and we finally arrived at the following conclusion. Well, conjecture. This is our conjecture. We are saying that there is a certain... See, the representation theory people who study periodic groups and local Langlands and so on, they want you to tell them what this is. Well, that's very difficult. By the way, that's not easy. That's quite a difficult problem. In fact, I think it's very difficult. On the other hand, this thing is easy. To describe this is easy. This, I think you could make a computer program that could do this. Oh, I did it backwards?
Yeah, you did backwards.
Oh, I did it backwards. Thank you very much. I did it backwards. This is very, very difficult. This is what the representation theory people want to know. They want you to tell them what this is. And that is a very, very difficult question. On the other hand, this thing is easy. This I think you could make a computer program that could calculate this. I mean, you'll have a torus, right? We're taking Bernstein's torus, and this finite group acting on Bernstein's torus, it's acting in a very special way. It's acting as automorphisms of that algebraic group. It's just a subgroup of the n by n invertible matrices, a finite subgroup of the n by n invertible matrices with entries the complex number with entries the integers, the ordinary integers. It's a finite subgroup of GLNZ. And it's acting in the usual way on a complex torus. I think you could make a computer program that could calculate this, could tell you what this is. But this thing is really tough. I mean, this thing is really hard. So we are saying there's a definite resemblance between these two things. Because this is what developed over the years, that we could see in example after example that these two things were in fact very close. So let me try to give you the conjecture. I mean, all right, this is the idea, of course. So let me try to explain to you our conjecture. First, I would like to tell you our conjecture at a topological level, and then at a level of honest representation theory. So let's discuss the conjecture at a topological level. Now, it's part of what Bernstein did that he assigns to each alpha, in other words, to each connected component, he assigns an ideal I sub alpha in the Hecke algebra, such that the primitive ideal space of I sub alpha is X sub alpha. He then proves that the Hecke algebra is the direct sum, as an algebra. It's the direct sum of these. This is a purely algebraic direct sum. This then implies, you have to prove something here, it's not immediate, but it implies that the periodic cycle cohomology, purely algebraic, is the direct sum of these. Now, so this Bernstein proves. It follows from what Bernstein does. So this is a fact. It's a corollary of what Bernstein does that associated to the hard one. See, I'm getting it right this time because the easy one is not there. So associated to the honest one, the hard one, the one that's difficult to calculate, associated to that is a well-defined, in other words, it's canonically defined map from the periodic cyclic homology of the coordinate algebra of this affine variety to the periodic cyclic homology of this I sub alpha. So of course, you think of this as being the topological homology of this, the cohomology, the topological cohomology of this affine variety, and you think of this heuristically as the cohomology of the connected component. But
and if you use a module over all of this quotient space, the upper module of the alpha will be the same as this vector. Because this should somehow reflect the affinity.
Probably it is, I suppose. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head, but I think it's pretty good. It better be.
It better be, yes.
If it isn't, I think there's something wrong. Yeah. So I suspect it is. Now, yes, it's a finite morphism. Yeah, this is a typical example of finite morphism. Yeah, it's definitely a finite morphism. No question about that. Yeah, this is a typical example of what's called in algebraic geometry a finite morphism. That is the map to the quotient space. Yeah. Yep. So it is faithfully fine. Yep. Okay. So, at a topological level, the conjecture of Roger and Anne-Marie Aubert and me is this. We're saying at a topological level that if you, we're saying that, see, here we have what follows from Bernstein's theory. Here we have cohomology, usual topological cohomology. Well, I mean, this is an affine variety, and we project it here, we get a map in cohomology. And we are saying that the two horizontal arrows are isomorphism. Well, this one definitely is an isomorphism. I mean, there's nothing... This is a fact. Whenever you take the coordinate algebra of an affine variety and you take its periodic cyclic homology, you get the cohomology. You get the direct sum of the even or the odd cohomology groups of that affine variety. That is a fact. That's a theorem. So this definitely is an isomorphism, and we're saying there's a commutative diagram in which this one is an isomorphism. So in other words, we're saying that the periodic cyclic homology of Bernstein's ideal is just the cohomology of this extended quotient. So, a remark, this is the conjecture at a topological level. It says that topologically speaking, it's saying that the two things we are interested in are indistinguishable. Now, this conjecture, that is, this topological statement, in my opinion, is a very, very good bet. I mean, I really would be willing to bet that this is true. And which means, so these two things, this and this, according, if the topological conjecture is true, these two things are topologically indistinguishable. That means that in real life, if we actually look at these two things, they cannot be drastically different. They cannot be so different as to affect the periodic cyclic homology. Well, that's a very interesting question. For some time, I was waiting for what I call Karubi and his friends to invent the right kind of K-theory. We don't have the right kind of K-theory for this problem. So, and I finally decided that we cannot wait forever for Karubi and his friends to come up with the right kind of K-theory. Well, you could do things like that, but the thing is, there's a pretty good candidate for the right kind of K-theory. What the right kind of K-theory probably is that you take the coordinate algebra of the affine variety or of the Heck algebra. You take that coordinate algebra, you tensor it algebraically with the compact operators, and then take the Quillen K-theory of that. That is probably, or maybe with a Schatten class or something. I mean, You take the coordinate algebra, you then tensor it algebraically with a Schatten class, with trace class operators, or let's say with compact operators, and then you take the Krull-Kahn theory of that.
What you said about that, what I understand is you are comparing two kinds of covariance. There is one which is complicated,
which is XFI. Yes. Yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes. This is a very interesting question. I will not have time to explain today. Maybe next time I'll have a chance to explain. We all know that there's Moretti equivalence. I mean, we can talk about two algebras being Moretti equivalent. So, I mean, this means that there are bimodules and so on, which have to satisfy various conditions. And Moretti equivalence preserves everything. Everything you can really think of basically is preserved by Moretti equivalence. Part of what Anne-Marie Aubert and Roger Parma and I do is we define a weakening of Moretti equivalence. We define a new equivalence relation on algebras. I won't have time to explain this. But we define a new equivalence relation on algebras, which is weaker than Moretti equivalence. That is, it is easier for algebras to be equivalent in the new equivalence relation. If they were Moretti equivalent, they are equivalent in the new equivalence relation, but the converse is not true. So we don't have a good name for the new equivalence relation. We are calling it geometrically equivalent. And it is important in our conjecture that the ideal that Bernstein assigns to the connected component it's part of our conjecture. This is only true conjecturally, but like I say, we have checked this in many examples, that this ideal that Bernstein assigns is geometrically, it's not Moretti equivalent. If it had been Moretti equivalent, the representation theory people would have discovered this a long, long time ago. But we are saying it is geometrically equivalent to the coordinate algebra of the extended quotient. Now, the question Alain is raising is very interesting, because then you have to ask, what does this preserve, this new equivalence relation? It does preserve periodic cyclic homology. It preserves invariance of a K-theoretic type only up to torsion, only up to multiplication. For example, we are all used to the fact that if you take some algebra A, it is Moretti equivalent to, let's say, the n by n matrices over A. And of course, that amounts to saying that if you map an element in the algebra to the matrix, which is zero everywhere, right, except in, let's say, the upper left-hand corner, then this homomorphism of algebras is essentially equivalent to the Moretti equivalence. In the new equivalence relation, it will give an equivalence in the new equivalence relation to take the group element and map it just down the diagonal, like that, and zeros elsewhere. Yeah, but it preserves the periodic cyclic homology. So it's only the periodic cyclic homology, it's only up K theoretic type invariants are only preserved up to torsion. It's a kind of rational Moretti equivalence. Yeah, it's a kind of rational Moretti equivalence. And so in the end, I was very glad that we just didn't continue to wait for Karubi and his friends to come up with the right kind of K-theory, because if we had waited, it would have been a waste of time, because it will only be preserved up to torsion anyway. Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a lot weaker. Yeah, let me give you an example of the new equivalence relation, some of the things you can do with the new equivalence relation. We are very familiar in seesaw algebras with the following basic example. We have a unit interval, and then we have a double point here, right? So the algebra for this is you look at functions from the unit interval. You look at functions from the unit interval to 2x2 matrices, continuous functions, of course. We are working with seesaw algebra, continuous functions. But you require that f of 1 be of the form, the off-diagonal terms must be 0. Right? You can have anything there, anything there. You require the two off-diagonal terms to be 0. Well, of course, this is not Moretti equivalent to the algebra for this. Right? There's no way that these two things are Moretti equivalent. In the new equivalence relation, they are Moretti equivalent. In the new equivalence relation, they are equivalent. The new equivalence relation allows you to pull apart strata, of course, in a reasonable way. You cannot just go in there and completely arbitrarily start pulling things apart. But it allows you, in a reasonable way, to pull strata apart, and therefore you have some chance of getting from a non-commutative algebra like this to this. These algebras, in a certain sense, are only very mildly non-commutative because it's part of Bernstein's theory that this thing is canonically Morita equivalent to a K-alpha algebra of finite type, where K alpha is the coordinate algebra of the ordinary quotient. So it's canonically equivalent to a unital algebra which contains this thing in the center of the unital algebra, and it's a finite type. That means as a module over this, it is finitely generated. So in a certain sense, these are only rather mildly non-commutative, and our conjecture is saying that in the new equivalence relation, which allows you to tear strata apart, it actually will be equivalent to this commutative algebra. This is a possibility. Yeah. Well, this is a possibility. We are saying that what you are calling defined structure can be resolved within the kind of equivalence that we allow into a commutative algebra. Okay, now I will now finish quickly. I just wanted to give you some idea. So the conjecture says that topologically these two things are indistinguishable. All right, that's the topological part of the conjecture. That topologically these two things you are interested in are indistinguishable. So now I want to give you just a brief indication of the conjecture at a more refined level. So at a more refined level, we are saying that we're saying that Bernstein's map is 1-to-1, that the real life thing, the real true life Bernstein map, we're saying is 1-to-1 if and only if the action of gamma alpha on T alpha is free. When it's free, the extended quotient and the ordinary quotient are exactly the same thing. So this had better be true, otherwise I apologize. If this isn't true, then it's okay. Secondly, we are saying that in the general case, when the action is not free, usually, by the way, this is unusual. It's unusual that the action of Bernstein's finite group is free. There are some examples like that. We looked at examples like that, and it did work out correctly. But we are saying in general that when the action of Bernstein's finite group is not free, we're saying that there will be a bijection. So this is a bijection of sets from the extended quotient to the connected component. There'll be a with the following properties. So that there is a bijection of sets is absolutely nothing, because these two sets have the same cardinality. That's nothing. The whole question is that there should be a bijection of sets with properties, with good properties. So the first property is that this diagram does not commute. Now, I gave a talk about this and there were some experts on p-adic groups in the audience, and I didn't explain this point, and they assured me after the talk that I was speaking complete nonsense, and I had to explain to them that I wasn't saying that this diagram commutes. The point is there is an obstruction, there is something you cannot overcome that prevents this diagram from commuting. And that obstruction is that if you take the true thing, the real life thing, the Bernstein map, from the connected component to the ordinary quotient, this has a subvariety in here where this map fails to be one-to-one, the so-called variety of reducibility. So I'll call that R sub alpha for reducibility. Now over in the easy, on the easy side, where we take the extended quotient, this one also will have, so to speak, a variety of reducibility. That is, there'll be some locus in here where the pre-image has more than one point. So let's call that something. Let's call that S alpha. Now, the diagram cannot commute because R alpha and S alpha, generally speaking, will not be the same. Therefore, there is no way to make that diagram commute. But it's part of our conjecture that even though these two things are, that the next best thing happens. These two things are not the same, but there will be what the algebraic geometry people call a flat family connecting one to the other. One will algebraically deform to the other. So let me explain that point. So this diagram does not commute. In the non-commutative diagram, this bijection that we are conjecturing that this bijection exists, this will be continuous, where the extended quotient has the Zariski topology and X alpha has, and the connected component has the Jacobson topology. And the composition, that is, if we go by this bijection, which is supposed to exist, and then down by Bernstein's map, this will be a morphism of algebraic varieties. We are conjecturing that this composition is a morphism of algebraic varieties. That means we now have two maps of algebraic varieties. We have the easy one. This is a map of algebraic varieties. And then we have this one, which is only conjectural. This one. So we have two morphisms of affine varieties. And we are saying that these morphisms of affine varieties, that one of them deforms algebraically to the other. So we're saying that there's actually an algebraic family of algebraic varieties where at one you get the easy thing. At one you get the easy thing that we made up, and at the square root of Q is the order of the residue field. At square root of Q, you get the composition of the bijection and the honest Bernstein one. Okay. So, in other words, the diagram doesn't commute, but it does the next best thing it possibly could. There's no way that diagram can commute. This is saying that it comes as close to commuting as it possibly could. Well, we're conjecturing that this bijection exists and that it is continuous. Yes, it's just a continuous map of topological spaces. Yes. Yeah, that will again be an algebraic map. You can look at it this way. You can look at it this way if you like. We use this bijection to give the connected component the structure of an affine variety, and then Bernstein's map becomes a morphism of affine varieties. That's an equivalent way of formulating it. Use the bijection to give the It's composition. It's composition of we have something which definitely is an affine variety, namely this. Then we have a map of that to the connected component. And then we have Bernstein's map from the connected component down. We're saying that that is a morphism of algebraic frame. Oh, I think what you are saying, yeah. Okay. Oh, wait a second. No, I'm going to make a last point and then I'll stop. Following the precedent of the previous speaker. This is the last thing I shall say today. Because this is crucial. This is absolutely crucial. And then I promise you I will stop. Okay, so I won't explain this. All I will say is we are saying that the deformation from one morphism to another is of an extremely simple type. It's just given by a bunch of co-characters. A co-character is a map from C cross to the torus, a map of algebraic groups. We're saying that the deformation is just given by a bunch of co-characters, by a simple formula involving co-characters. This is the most subtle and delicate part of the conjecture, because it is at this point that the conjecture begins to connect to what are called Langlands parameters and the local Langlands conjecture. A Langlands parameter is a map from what's called the Weyl group cross SL2C into, it's required to be semi-simple, so it's going into a torus. Well, the torus is this torus, and if you just restrict to the SL2C part, that's giving these co-characters. So this is where we begin to connect to local language. I apologize for shortening your lunch, but it was not totally my fault. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes, yes. All of that works. Yes. That's part of the conjecture.
Because this is more
within each. Oh, no, the K theory, you got to be careful. It's only going to preserve K theory up to torsion. That was this whole discussion with Alan. Oh, yeah, that's true. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. This is definitely true. This is definitely true. That's a C-star algebra direct sum.
This could just be the cross, but...
This is a C-star algebra direct sum.
Okay, good. So then this is... I would have guessed that this would be just the cross button graph on a group acting on the torus. Is that false? Why are you lying?
Well, you're on the right track. You're thinking the right way. That is definitely false. But what we are saying is that... What we are